Fox's Christian Martyrs of the World by John Fox. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto death. Introduction. John Fox was born in 1516 in Boston, Lincolnshire, England. At the age of 16, he went to Oxford, where he received his B.A. in 1537, became a professor, and completed his master's in 1543. While teaching at Oxford, he became good friends with Hugh Latimer and William Tyndale, embracing Protestantism. His views were more extreme than his college allowed, so he left the university in 1545, married, and moved to London, where he became the tutor of the Duke of Norfolk's grandchildren. Fox was ordained a deacon of the Church of England and worked for the Reformation, writing several tracts and beginning work on his account of Christian martyrs, but was forced to leave the country in 1553 when the Catholic Queen Mary took the throne. The first part of his book was published in 1554 in Strasbourg, France. He then went to Frankfurt to support John Knox's Calvinistic party and moved to Basel, Switzerland, where he served as a printer's proofreader. Manuscripts and eyewitness accounts of the Protestants' persecution under Queen Mary were forwarded to Fox in Basel, and he continued to work on his book, publishing the completed manuscript in 1559, the year after Queen Elizabeth I took the throne. Returning to England, he filled in more details, translated the book into English, and printed it in March of 1563 under the title Acts and Monuments of These Latter and Perilous Days. Becoming popularly known as the Book of Martyrs, the text was widely read by English Puritans, shaping popular opinion about Catholicism for at least a century. Fox was ordained an Anglican priest in 1560, but refused all church offices because of his Puritan beliefs. He continued to preach and publish his sermons, however, ministered to the victims of the plague of 1563, then begged Queen Elizabeth not to execute Anabaptists in 1577 and the Jesuits in 1581. Meanwhile, the Book of Martyrs was installed in English churches, read to the shipmates of Sir Francis Drake, and studied by Puritan families who considered it a vital part of the education of their children. Fox died in April of 1587 and was buried at St. Giles Church, Cripplegate, London. His wife survived him by 18 years. They had at least 5 children. This edition is a retelling of Fox's major stories in modern English and should be readily understandable by both children and adults. Chapter 1. The Persecution of Early Christians. In the Gospel of Matthew, we read that Simon Peter was the first person to openly acknowledge Jesus as the Son of God, and that Jesus, seeking God's hand in this acknowledgement, called Peter a rock on which he would build his church, a church that even the gates of hell would not be able to defeat. This indicates 3 things. First, that Christ will have a church in this world. Secondly, that the church would be persecuted, not only by the world, but also by the powers of hell. Thirdly, despite its persecutions, the church would survive. The whole history of the church to this day verifies this prophecy of Christ. Princes, kings, and other rulers of this world have used all their strength and cunning against the church, yet it continues to endure and hold its own. The storms it has overcome are remarkable. I have written this history so the wonderful works of God within the church will be visible to all who might profit from them. Of all the people who heard Jesus speak, the Pharisees and scribes should have been the first to accept him, since they were so familiar with God's law. Yet they persecuted and rejected him, choosing to remain subject to Caesar, and it was Caesar who eventually destroyed them. God's punishment also fell heavily on the Romans. Hearing of Christ's works, death, and resurrection, Emperor Tiberius proposed to the Roman Senate that he be adored as God, but the senators refused, preferring the emperor to the King of Heaven. In reply, God stirred their own emperors against them, causing most of the Senate to be destroyed, and the city of Rome to be afflicted for nearly 300 years. Tiberius became a tyrant, killing his own mother, his nephews, the princes of the city, and his own counselors. Suetonius reported him to be so stern that on one day alone he saw 20 people executed. Pilate, under whom Christ was crucified, was sent to Rome and banished to the town of Vienne in Daphne, where he eventually committed suicide. Agrippa the elder was even imprisoned by Tiberius for some time.
After Tiberius's death came Caligula, who demanded to be worshipped as a god. He banished Herod Antipas, the murderer of John the Baptist, and condemner of Christ, and was assassinated in the fourth year of his reign. Following 13 cruel years under Claudius, the people of Rome fell under the power of Nero, who reigned for 14 years, killing most of the Roman Senate and destroying the whole Roman order of knighthood. He was so cruel and inhumane that he put to death his own mother, his brother-in-law, his sister, his wife, and his instructors Seneca and Lucian. He ordered Rome set on fire in 12 places while he sang the verses of Homer. To avoid the blame for this, he accused the Christians of setting the fires and caused them to be persecuted. In the year AD 70, Titus, the father of Vespasian, destroyed Jerusalem and all of Galilee, killing over 1,100,000 Jews and selling the rest into slavery. So we see that those who refused Jesus were made to suffer for their actions. The Apostles. The first apostle to suffer after the martyrdom of Stephen was James, the brother of John. Clement tells us, when this James was brought to the tribunal seat, he that brought him, and was the cause of his trouble, seeing him to be condemned, and that he should suffer death, was in such sort moved within heart and conscience, that, as he went to the execution, he confessed himself also, of his own accord, to be a Christian. And so were they led forth together, where in the way he desired of James to forgive him for what he had done. After, James had a little paused within himself upon the matter. Turning to him, he said, "Peace be to thee, brother," and kissed him, and both were beheaded together. AD 36. Thomas preached to Parthians, Medes, Persians, Carameans, Hyrcanians, Bactrians, and Magicians. He was killed in Kalamina, India. Simon, brother of Jude and James the Younger, who were all sons of Mary Cleophas and Alphaeus, was bishop of Jerusalem after James. He was crucified in Egypt during the reign of the Roman Emperor Trajan. Simon the Apostle, called Cneus, and Zealots, preached in Mauritania, Africa, and Britain. He was also crucified. Mark, the first bishop of Alexandria, preached the gospel in Egypt. He was burned and buried in a place called Buclonus during Trajan's reign. Bartholomew is said to have preached in India and translated the Gospel of Matthew into their tongue. He was beaten, crucified, and beheaded in Albanopolis, Armenia. Andrew, Peter's brother, preached to the Scythians, Sogdians, and the Saith in Sebastopolis, Ethiopia, in the year 80. He was crucified by Aegeus, the governor of the Edessians, and buried in Petra, in Archaea. Bernard and St. Cyprian mention the confession and martyrdom of this blessed apostle. Partly from them and partly from other reliable writers, we gather the following material. When Andrew, through his diligent preaching, had brought many to the faith of Christ, Aegeus, the governor, asked permission of the Roman Senate to force all Christians to sacrifice to the honor of the Roman idols. Andrew thought he should resist Aegeus, and went to him, telling him that a judge of men should first know and worship his judge in heaven. While worshipping the true God, Andrew said, he should banish all false gods and blind idols from his mind. Furious at Andrew, Aegeus demanded to know if he was the man who had recently overthrown the temple of the gods and persuaded men to become Christians, a, quote, superstitious sect that had recently been declared illegal by the Romans. Andrew replied that the rulers of Rome didn't understand the truth. The Son of God, who came into this world for man's sake, taught that the Roman gods were devils, enemies of mankind, teaching men to offend God and causing him to turn away from them. By serving the devil, men fall into all kinds of wickedness. Andrew said that after they die, nothing but their evil deeds are remembered. The proconsul ordered Andrew not to preach these things any more, or he would face a speedy crucifixion. Whereupon Andrew replied, "I would not have preached the honor and glory of the cross if I feared the death of the cross." He was condemned to be crucified for teaching a new sect and taking away the religion of the Roman gods. Andrew, going toward the place of the execution and seeing the cross waiting for him, never changed his expression, neither did he fail in his speech. His body fainted not, nor did his reason fail him, as often happens to men about to die. He said, "O cross, most welcome and longed for, with a willing mind, joyfully and desirously I come to you, being the scholar of him which did hang on you, because I have always been your lover and yearned to embrace you."
Matthew wrote his gospel to the Jews in the Hebrew tongue. After he converted Ethiopia and all Egypt, Hyrcanus the king sent someone to kill him with a spear. After years of preaching to the barbarous nations, Philip was stoned and crucified at Hierapolis, Phrygia, and buried there with his daughter. Of James, the brother of the Lord, we read the following. James, being considered a just and perfect man, governed the church with the apostles. He drank no wine or any strong drink, ate no meat, and never shaved his head. He was the only man allowed to enter into the holy place, for he never wore wool, just linen. He would enter into the temple alone, fall on his knees, and ask permission for the people, doing this so often that his knees lost their sense of feeling and became hardened like the knees of a camel. Because of his holy life, James was called the Just and the Safeguard of the people. When many of their chief men began to be converted, the Jews, scribes, and Pharisees began to fear that soon all the people would decide to follow Jesus. They met James, saying, "We beg you to restrain the people, for they believe Jesus as though he were the Christ. Persuade those who come to the Passover to think correctly about Christ, because they will all listen to you. Stand on top of the temple so you can be heard by everyone." During Passover, the scribes and Pharisees put James on top of the temple, calling out to him, "You just man, whom we all ought to obey, this people is going astray after Jesus, who was crucified." And James answered, "Why do you ask me of Jesus, the Son of Man? He sits on the right hand of the Most High, and shall come in the clouds of heaven." Hearing this, many were persuaded and glorified God, saying, "Hosanna to the Son of David." Then the scribes and Pharisees realized they had done the wrong thing by allowing James to testify of Christ. They cried out, "Oh, this man is seduced too." Then they went up and threw James off the temple. But James wasn't killed by the fall. He turned, fell on his knees, and called, "O Lord God, Father, I beg you to forgive them, for they know not what they do." They decided to stone James, but a priest said to them, "Wait, what are you doing? The just man is praying for you." But one of the men there, a fuller, took the instrument he used to beat the cloth and hit James on the head, killing him. And they buried him where he fell. James was a true witness for Christ to the Jews and to the Gentiles. The first persecution. The first of 10 persecutions was stirred up by Nero about AD 64. His rage against the Christians was so fierce that Eusebius records, "A man might see cities full of men's bodies, the old lying together with the young, and the dead bodies of women cast out naked without reverence of that sex in the open streets." Many Christians in those days thought that Nero was the Antichrist because of his cruelty and abominations. The Apostle Peter was condemned to death during this persecution, although some say he escaped. It is known that many Christians encouraged him to leave the city, and the story goes that as he came to the city's gate, Peter saw Jesus coming to meet him. "Lord, where are you going?" Peter asked. "I am come again to be crucified," was the answer. Seeing that his suffering was understood, Peter returned to the city, where Jerome tells us he was crucified head down at his own request, saying he was not worthy to be crucified the same way the Lord was. Paul also suffered under this persecution when Nero sent two of his esquires, Phrygia and Parthemius, to bring him to his execution. They found Paul instructing the people and asked him to pray for them so they might believe. Receiving Paul's assurance that they would soon be baptized, the two men led him out of the city to the place of execution, where Paul was beheaded. This persecution ended under Vespasian's reign, giving the Christians a little peace. The second persecution. The second persecution began during the reign of Domitian, the brother of Titus. Domitian exiled John to the island of Patmos, but on Domitian's death, John was allowed to return to Ephesus in the year AD 97. He remained there until the reign of Trajan, governing the churches in Asia, and writing his gospel until he died about the age of 100. Why did the Roman emperors and Senate persecute the Christians so? First of all, they didn't understand that Christ's kingdom is not a temporal kingdom, and they feared for their powerful leadership roles if too many Christians followed Christ. Secondly, Christians despised false Roman gods, preferring to worship only the true living God. Whatever happened in Rome, famine, disease, earthquake, wars, bad weather, was blamed on the Christians who defied Roman gods. Death was not considered enough punishment for the Christians, who were subjected to the cruelest treatment possible. They were whipped, disemboweled, torn apart, and stoned. Plates of hot iron were laid on them. They were strangled, eaten by wild animals, hung, and tossed on horns of bulls. After they were dead, their bodies were piled in heaps and left to rot without burial. Nevertheless, the church continued to grow, deeply rooted in the doctrine of the apostles and watered with the blood of the saints. The Third Persecution. During the Third Persecution, Pliny II wrote to the Emperor Trajan, complaining that thousands of Christians were being killed daily, although none of them had done anything worthy of persecution. During this persecution, Ignatius was condemned to death because he professed Christ. At the time, he was living in Antioch, next in line as bishop after Peter. As he made the trip from Syria to Rome, under heavy guard, he preached to the churches he passed and asked the Church of Rome not to try to save him. Condemned to be thrown to the lions, Ignatius replied, "I am the wheat of Christ. I am going to be ground with the teeth of wild beasts, that I might be found pure bread." The Fourth Persecution. After a respite, the Christians again came under persecution, this time from Marcus Aurelius, in AD 161. One of those who suffered this time was Polycarp, the venerable bishop of Smyrna. 3 days before he was captured, Polycarp dreamed that a pillow under his head caught fire, and when he awoke, he told those around him that he would burn alive for Christ's sake. Hearing his captors had arrived one evening, Polycarp left his bed and welcomed them, ordered a meal prepared for them, and asked for an hour alone to pray. The soldiers were so impressed by Polycarp's advanced age and composure that they began to wonder why they had been sent to take him, but as soon as he had finished his prayers, they put him on an ass and brought him into the city. As he entered the stadium with his guards, a voice from heaven was heard to say, "Be strong, Polycarp, and play the man." No one nearby saw anyone speaking, but many people heard the voice. Brought before the tribunal and the crowd, Polycarp refused to deny Christ, although the proconsul begged him to consider yourself and have piety on your great age. "Reproach Christ, and I will release you." Polycarp replied, 86 years I have served him, and he never once wronged me. How can I blaspheme my king who saved me?" Threatened with wild beasts and fire, Polycarp stood his ground. "What are you waiting for? Do whatever you please." The crowd demanded Polycarp's death, gathering wood for the fire and preparing to tie him to the stake. "Leave me," he said. "He who will give me strength to sustain the fire will help me not to flinch from the pile." So they bound him, but did not nail him to the stake. As soon as Polycarp finished his prayer, the fire was lit, but it leapt up around him, leaving him unburned, until the people convinced a soldier to plunge a sword into him. When he died, so much blood gushed out that the fire was immediately extinguished. The soldiers then placed his body into the fire and burned it to ashes, which some Christians later gathered up and buried properly. In this same persecution, the Christians of Lyons and Vienne, two cities in France, also suffered, including Sanctus of Vienne, Martyrus, Alatus of Pergamus, and the woman Blandina, all of whom endured extreme torture and death with fortitude and grace. The Fifth Persecution, AD 200. During the reign of Servius, the Christians had several years of rest and could worship God without fear of punishment. But after a time, the hatred of the ignorant mob again prevailed, and the old laws were remembered and put in force against them. Fire, sword, wild beast, and imprisonment were resorted to again, and even the dead bodies of Christians were stolen from their graves and mutilated. Yet the faithful continued to multiply. Tertullian, who lived at this time, said that if the Christians had gone away from the Roman territories, the empire would have been greatly weakened. By now, the persecutions had extended to northern Africa, which was a Roman province, and many were murdered in that area. One of these was Perpetua, a married lady, 26 years old, with a baby at her breast. On being taken before the proconsul Minutius, Perpetua was commanded to sacrifice to the idols. Refusing to do so, she was put in a dark dungeon and deprived of her child. But two of her keepers, Tertius and Pomponius, allowed her out in fresh air several hours a day, during which time she was allowed to nurse her child. Finally, the Christians were summoned to appear before the judge and urged to deny their Lord, but all remained firm. When Perpetua's turn came, her father suddenly appeared, carrying her infant in his arms, and he begged her to save her own life for the sake of her child. Even the judge seemed to be moved. "Spare the gray hairs of your father," he said. "Spare your child. Offer sacrifice for the welfare of the emperor." Perpetua answered, "I will not sacrifice." "Are you a Christian?" demanded Hilarianus, the judge. "I am a Christian," was her answer. Perpetua and all the other Christians tried with her that day were ordered killed by wild beasts as a show for the crowd on the next holiday. They entered the place of execution clad in their simplest of robes, Perpetua singing a hymn of triumph.
The men were to be torn to pieces by leopards and bears. Perpetua and a young woman named Felicitas were hung up in nets, at first naked, but the crowd demanded that they should be allowed their clothing. When they were again returned to the arena, a bull was let loose on them. Felicitas fell, seriously wounded. Perpetua was tossed with her loose robe torn and her hair falling loose, but she hastened to the side of the dying Felicitas and gently raised her from the ground. When the bull refused to attack them again, they were dragged out of the arena, to the disappointment of the crowd, which wanted to see their deaths. Finally, brought back in to be killed by gladiators, Perpetua was assigned to a trembling young man, who stabbed her weakly several times, not being used to such scenes of violence. When she saw how upset the young man was, Perpetua guided his sword to a vital area and died. The Seventh Persecution, A.D. 249. By now, the heathen temples of Rome were almost forsaken, and the Christian churches were crowded with converts. The emperor, Decius, decided it was time to crush the Christians once and for all. Fabian, the bishop of Rome, was the first person of authority to feel the severity of this persecution. The former emperor, Philip, had put his treasure into the care of Fabian. When Decius examined the treasure, there was far less than he had expected, so he had Fabian arrested and beheaded. Decius, having built a pagan temple at Ephesus, commanded everyone in the city to sacrifice to its idols. The order was refused by seven of his own soldiers. Maximus, Martinius, Jonas, Malchus, Dionysius, Constantinius, and Serian. The emperor, willing to try a little persuasion, gave them time to consider until he returned from a journey. But, in his absence, they escaped and hid in a cave. Decius was told of this on his return, and the mouth of the cave was closed up, so all seven soldiers starved to death. Theodora, a beautiful young lady of Antioch, refused to sacrifice to the Roman idols and was condemned to a prison. Didymus, her Christian lover, disguised himself as a Roman soldier and went into Theodora's cell, where he convinced her to put on his armor and escape. When he was discovered, Didymus was taken to the governor and condemned to death. When she heard of Didymus's sentence, Theodora threw herself at the judge's feet and begged that she be the one to suffer, not Didymus. The judge ordered them both beheaded, and their bodies burned. Origen, the celebrated author and teacher of Alexandria, was arrested at the age of 64 and thrown into prison in chains, his feet placed in the stocks, which held his legs stretched widely apart. Even though Origen was rich and famous, he received no mercy. He was threatened by fire and tormented by every means available, but his fortitude carried him through it all, even when the judge ordered the torturers to prolong his suffering. During the torture, Decius died, and his successor began a war with the Goths, which turned the empire's attention away from the Christians. Origen was freed. He lived in Tyre until he died at the age of 69. Chapter 2. The Eighth Persecution, A.D. 257. When Valerian was first made emperor, he was a moderate and kind to the Christians. But then he fell under the influence of an Egyptian magician named Macrianus, and ordered the persecutions to continue, which they did for the next 3 years and 6 months. Stephen, bishop of Rome, was beheaded, and Saturninus, bishop of Toulouse, was attacked and seized by the crowd there for preventing the oracles from speaking. On refusing to sacrifice to the idols, he was fastened by the feet to the tail of a bull, which was then driven down the steps of the temple, dragging Saturninus until his head opened and his brains fell out. None of the Christians in Toulouse had the courage to carry away his dead body, until two women took it and buried it in a ditch. In Rome, Lawrence was brought before the authorities, who knew he was not only a minister of the sacraments, but also a distributor of the church's riches. When they demanded he hand over all that the church possessed, Lawrence asked for 3 days to collect it. On the third day, when the persecutor demanded the wealth of the church, Lawrence stretched his arms over a group of poor Christians he had gathered together. "These are the precious treasures of the church," he said. "What more precious jewels can Christ have than those in whom he promised to dwell?" Furious at being tricked and out of his mind with anger, Lawrence's persecutor ordered him whipped, beaten, tied to burning hot plates of iron, then laid on a bed of iron over a fire and roasted alive. The first English martyr was a man named Alban, who was converted by a poor clerk who took shelter in his house. When the authorities eventually came for the clerk, Alban dressed in his clothes and went in his place. The judge recognized Alban and demanded he sacrifice to the heathen gods or die. When Alban refused, he was tortured and beheaded. The Ninth Persecution, A.D. 270. This persecution began under the Emperor Aurelian. Among those who suffered at this time was Felix, Bishop of Rome, who was beheaded. Agapitus, a young Roman who sold his estate and gave the money to the poor, was seized as a Christian, tortured, and then brought to Praenest, a city near Rome, where he was beheaded. These are the only martyrs whose names were recorded during this reign. The Tenth Persecution, A.D. 303. In the beginning of the Tenth Persecution, which was in the 19th year of his reign, the emperor, Diocletian, appointed Maximian to share his throne with him, and the two of them chose Galerius and Constantius to serve under them. Under these two rulers, the Christians were again persecuted furiously, a state that would continue until A.D. 313, even though Diocletian and Maximian gave up their offices in the year 305. Constantius and Galerius divided the empire between them, Galerius taking the eastern countries and Constantius ruling France, Spain, and Britain. Meanwhile, the Roman soldiers set up Maxentius as their Caesar in Rome. While Galerius and Maxentius continued the persecution for 7 or 8 years, Constantius became a supporter of the Christians in his empire. Being an enlightened, intelligent ruler who was always concerned for the welfare of his subjects, never waging unjust wars or aiding those who did. Churches were terribly persecuted in other parts of the empire, but Constantius gave Christians the freedom to live and worship as they chose, even appointing them as his closest protectors and advisors. Constantius died in A.D. 306 and was buried at York, England. His son, Constantine, an English-born Christian, succeeded him, a ruler every bit as compassionate and dedicated as his father. In Rome, Maxentius was ruling as a tyrant, killing his own noblemen, confiscating their goods for himself, and practicing magic, the only thing he seemed to do well. In the beginning of his reign, he pretended to be a friend of the Christians, but only to win popular support, while he secretly continued the persecution. The citizens and senators of Rome soon grew wary of Maxentius's tyranny and wickedness, and petitioned Constantine to come free them. At first, Constantine tried to convince Maxentius to mend his ways, but when they had no effect, he gathered an army in Britain and France and began marching towards Italy in A.D. 313. Knowing he didn't have the support of his people, Maxentius had to rely on his magic arts and occasional ambushes of Constantine's advancing army, neither of which slowed Constantine's advance towards Rome. But as he neared Rome, Constantine began to feel nervous about the coming battle. He'd seen Maxentius defeat others by use of his magic, and he wished he had a force he could use against it. At one sunset, Constantine looked up at the south to see the bright form of the cross and the words, "In this overcome." He and the men with him were astonished at the sign, although no one was too sure what it actually meant. But one night, as Constantine slept, Christ appeared to him with the same cross, telling him to make a cross and carry before him into battle. This sign and its message wasn't given to induce superstitious worship of the cross, as though the cross had any power in itself, but as an admonition to seek Jesus and set forth the glory of his name. The next day, Constantine had a cross made of gold and precious stones, which he had carried before the army in place of his flag, which added confidence that God had blessed his cause. He hurried towards Rome and the showdown with Maxentius. Maxentius was now forced out of the city to meet Constantine on the far side of the Tiber River. After he crossed a bridge named Pons Milvius, Maxentius destroyed it, replacing it with an unstable bridge made of boats and planks, thinking to trap Constantine. The two armies clashed. Constantine drove Maxentius backwards, farther and farther, until in his haste to safety, he tried to retreat over the new bridge and fell into his own trap. His horse tumbled off the unstable planking, taking Maxentius and his armor to the bottom of the Tiber River, where he drowned. Maxentius was the last Roman persecutor of the Christians, whom Constantine set free after 300 years of oppression and death. Constantine so firmly established the rights of Christians to worship God that it would be 1,000 years before they would again suffer for their faith. For 300 years, the strongest and richest rulers in the world had tried to snuff out Christianity, using force, politics, torture, and death, everything at their disposal. Now, all those emperors were gone, and Christ and his church still stood. Persecutions under Julian, A.D. 361. Julian became the emperor at the death of his brother Constantius, the son of Constantine the Great. Although Julian had been educated by his father in the Christian faith, he was at heart a pagan, and no sooner was he seated on the throne than he made a public avowal of his belief and trust in the ancient gods of the heathen, earning himself the title Julian the Apostate. Julian restored idolatrous worship by opening the temples and ordering the magistrates and people to follow his example, but he did not make any laws against Christianity. He allowed every religious sect its freedom, although he exerted all the influence he could to restore the old faith. Although no violent deaths of Christians are recorded as resulting from any orders of Julian, several executions did take place around the empire on the orders of heathen governors and officers. Severus. Venus, the goddess of love, was revered by the Romans, and April was considered the appropriate month to celebrate the triumph of this goddess. During that month, her temples were thronged with worshippers, and her marble statues were decked with flowers. Severus, a Christian centurion in the Roman army, dared to raise his voice against this popular custom, not only refusing to take part in the heathen ceremony, but denouncing Venus herself. Enraged by his words, the crowd seized Severus and dragged him before the judge. He repeated his beliefs firmly in the judge's presence and was condemned to be taken before the temple of Venus to be insulted, stripped and scourged with a whip called the plumetta, which had lead balls tied to the end of each of its thongs. Severus was beaten by two strong men, delivered over to the public executioners, and beheaded. Cassian. Cassian was a schoolmaster in a town not far from Rome when he was arrested for refusing to sacrifice to idols. His judge decided that his punishment should be entrusted to his students, who didn't like their schoolmaster at all. He was bound and delivered to his students, who fell on him with their styles, the sharp-pointed pieces of iron used to write on the wax-covered tables, and stabbed him to death. Theodorus, a Christian, was seized and tortured. After being taken from the rack, he was asked how he could endure the pain so patiently. "At first I felt some pain," he replied, "but afterwards there appeared to be a young man beside me, who wiped the sweat from my face and refreshed me with cold water. I enjoyed it so much that I was sorry to be released." Marcus. Marcus, the bishop of Arethusa, a town in Thrace, destroyed a heathen temple and had a Christian church built in its place. This so enraged the heathens of the town that they waited until he was alone and captured him one day. After they had beaten him with sticks, they asked whether he would rebuild the temple he had torn down. Marcus not only refused to rebuild it, but threatened to destroy it again if anyone else rebuilt it. His persecutors looked around for some way to punish him, finally deciding on a plan that was as cruel as it was unusual. They tied Marcus with ropes and placed him in a large basket, which they hung in a tree after smearing the poor man's body with honey. After being hung up in the tree, Marcus was asked once more to restore the temple. He refused, and his tormentors left him to die from the stings of the wasps he attracted. Persecution by the Goths. During the reign of Constantine the Great, the light of the gospel penetrated into the land of the barbarians. In northeastern Europe, which was then called Scythia, some of the Goths were converted, but most of them continued as pagans. Frightgern, king of the western Goths, was a friend of the Romans, but Athanaric, king of the eastern Goths, was at war with them. The Christians, living in Frightgern's area, lived in peace, but Athanaric, being defeated by the Romans, took out his anger on the Christians in his land. Sabas was the first to feel the king's anger. He was a humble, modest man, eager to see the church expand. Athanaric sent out orders that everyone in his land had to sacrifice to the heathen gods and eat the meat that had been offered to the idols. If they refused, they would be put to death. Some of the heathens who had Christian relatives provided them with meat that hadn't been sacrificed to idols, but Sabas refused to take this way out. He not only refused to comply with the new laws, but publicly said that those who ate the substitute meat were not true Christians. Sabas was soon arrested and taken before the judge, who, seeing he was a poor, unimportant man, had him released. Soon, Sabas went to visit Sansala, a Christian missionary. On the third night after his arrival, they were both arrested by a party of soldiers. Sansala was allowed to dress himself and ride, but Sabas was forced to leave his clothing behind and walk. All during the journey, they drove him through thorns and briars, beating him all along the way. In the evenings, they stretched him between two beams, fastening his legs to one and his arms to the other, and left him that way for the night. Even when he was released by a woman who pitied him, Sabas refused to run away. In the morning, the soldiers tried to persuade both men to renounce their religion and eat the meat that had been consecrated to the idols. They refused, and although Sansala was finally set free, Sabas was drowned. Nistas, a Goth living near Danube with his parents, was a Christian too. One day, Athanari commanded an idol should be drawn around on a chariot in all the Christian towns. Everyone was ordered to worship the idol when it stopped in front of their house. Nistas refused to come out when the idol arrived at his house, so the house was set on fire, and everyone in it burned to death. Persecution by the Vandals, AD 429. The Vandals crossed over from Spain to the north coast of Africa and defeated the Roman army there, conquering the whole country under their leader, Genseric. Since the Vandals were of an Arian sect, they abused the Christians whenever they found them, laying waste to all their cities and ruining every beautiful or valuable object they found. They even burned the fields of grain, so anyone escaping their swords would die from famine. They plundered the churches and murdered the bishops and ministers in many cruel ways. Often they poured rancid, filthy oil down the throats of those they captured, drowning them. Others they martyred by stretching their limbs with cords until the veins and sinews burst. Old men found no mercy from them, and even innocent babies felt the rage of their barbarity. When a town held out against them, the Vandals brought a great number of Christians to the town walls and killed them, leaving their bodies to rot under the walls until the town had to surrender to escape the plague. After they took Carthage, the Vandals put the city's bishop and many other Christians into a leaky ship and committed it to the waves, thinking everyone on it would soon die. But the vessel arrived safely at another port. Several Christians were beaten, scourged, and banished to the desert, where God used them to convert many of the Moors to Christianity. Once Genseric discovered this, he sent orders that they and their converts should be tied by the feet to the chariots and dragged until they were beaten to pieces. The bishop of Uris was burned, and the bishop of Habensa was banished for refusing to turn over the sacred books. Archonemus, a devout Christian, was brought before Genseric himself for trial. Finding the man firm in his faith, Genseric ordered him beheaded, but privately told the executioner, "If the prisoner is courageous and willing to die, don't kill him. I don't want him to have the honor of being a martyr." When the executioner found Archonemus quite willing to die, he returned him to the prison, from which he soon disappeared, probably murdered in secret at the king's order. Cyrilla, the Arian bishop of Carthage, was a great enemy to those Christians who professed the pure faith. He persuaded Genseric that he could not allow so many of his subjects to practice their Christianity and enjoy any peace. Genseric first attempted to bribe the Christians away from their faith with promises of worldly gains, but they stood firm, saying, "We acknowledge but one Lord and one faith. You may do whatever you please with our bodies, for it is better to suffer a few temporary pains than to endure everlasting misery." Looking for an efficient way to kill so many people at once, the governor finally ordered them all put on a ship filled with wood and straw. The ship was then set on fire, and everyone on board was either drowned or burned to death. The names of the chief Christians on board the ship were Rusticus, Liberatus, Rogatus, Servus, Septimus, and Boniface. Telemachus. Rome was celebrating its temporary victory over Alaric, the Goth, in its usual manner, by watching the gladiators fight to the death in the arena, when suddenly there was an interruption. A rudely clad, robed figure boldly leapt down into the arena. Telemachus was one of the hermits who devoted themselves to a holy life of prayer and self-denial and kept themselves apart from the wicked life of Rome. Although few of the Roman citizens followed their example, most of them had great respect for these hermits, and the few that recognized Telemachus knew he had come from the wilds of Asia on a pilgrimage to visit the churches and celebrate Christmas in Rome. Without hesitating an instant, Telemachus advanced upon the two gladiators who were engaging in their life-and-death struggle. Laying a hand on one of them, he sternly reproved him for shedding innocent blood, and then, turning toward the thousands of angry faces around him, called to them, "Do not repay God's mercy in turning away the swords of your enemies by murdering each other." Angry shouts drowned his voice. "This is no place for preaching. On with the combat." Pushing Telemachus aside, the two gladiators prepared to continue their combat. But Telemachus stepped between them. Enraged at the interference of an outsider with their chosen vocation, the gladiators turned on Telemachus and stabbed him to death. The crowd fell silent, shocked by the death of this holy man. But his death had not been in vain, for from that day on, no more gladiators ever went into combat in the Colosseum. The Spanish Inquisition. The Inquisition of the Church of Rome was, in its days, one of the most terrible engines of tyranny ever created by man. It may be said to date from about the year 1200, when Pope Innocent III sent his inquisitors among the Waldenses and other sects differing from the Church, and continued until 1808. In its course, it totally crushed any Protestants living in Spain. Its final count numbered 31,912 people burned alive, and 291,450 imprisoned. In the 18 years that the Dominican monk Thomas of Torquemada led the Inquisition, 10,220 people were burned and 97,322 punished with the loss of property or imprisonment. Although its main victims were citizens of Spain, there were others who became its victims too. William Lithgow. William Lithgow was an Englishman born about 1580. Being fond of travel, he was on his way to Alexandria, Egypt, when he was suddenly attacked by 9 men who threw a black cloak over his head and dragged him to the governor's house in Malaga, Spain. There he was accused of being an English spy. Nothing Lithgow could say would convince the local authorities that he was only a tourist passing through the city, so it was decided to torture him until he made his confession. Lithgow was tortured on the rack, and then asked if he acknowledged the Pope's supremacy, to which he answered, "You almost murdered me for the pretended treason without any grounds. Now you intend to make me a martyr for my religion?" "You have been arrested as a spy and accused of treachery," his inquisitors replied. "Perhaps you are not a spy, but we have found your books and writings, and you surely are a heretic, and therefore deserve even worse punishment than you have received." They gave Lithgow 8 days to consider whether he would convert or not. During this time, the inquisitor and others argued frequently with him to no avail. At last, finding their arguments had no effect, and that their threats of torment couldn't shake him, they left Lithgow alone. The 8 days were soon over. Lithgow was asked one more time to convert and save his life. "I fear neither death nor fire," he replied. "I am prepared for both, so do your worst." That night, Lithgow was sentenced to 11 different tortures, and if he did not die from them, he was to be taken to Granada and burned after Easter. The first part of the sentence was carried out with cold-blooded cruelty, but it pleased God to give the poor victim strength of body and mind, and he survived. Then Lithgow waited with resignation for the day that would end his torments. All of this had been carried out in the strictest secrecy, since Lithgow was an English subject and not a citizen of Spain. But a servant boy happened to hear the city's mayor discuss Lithgow's case at dinner one night, and he secretly told the story to an English merchant in town named Mr. Wilde. Wilde told the story to other English merchants living in town, and to the English ambassador at Madrid, Sir Walter Aston, who quickly appealed to the King and Council of Spain, obtained an order for Lithgow's immediate release, and put him on board an English warship visiting the city. 2 months later, Lithgow arrived safely at Deptford, England, although his left arm remained useless to him for the rest of his life. Isaac Martin. Isaac Martin, an English trader, was living in Spain with his wife and 4 children. Because of his first name, the authorities decided Martin must be a Jew, and began to harass him to change his religion. In time, Martin decided it would be best if he left the country, but he made the mistake of telling one of his Spanish neighbors his plan, and was arrested in the middle of the night. Brought to his cell in the middle of the night, Martin was told, "You must keep a complete silence here, as if you were dead. You must not speak, or whistle, or sing, or make a noise that can be heard. And if you hear anybody cry or make a noise, you must be still and say nothing, under penalty of 200 lashes." Martin asked if he was allowed to walk around his cell. The jailer said he was, if he did so very quietly. All in all, Martin was called to 6 hearings before his inquisitor on the 26 trivial, untrue charges. He was promised a lawyer, then told the lawyers were not permitted to speak during a hearing. About a month later, a rope was put around his neck, and he was led by it to the altar of the great church for the crimes in which he stood convicted. The Lord of the Holy Office ordered him banished from Spain after receiving 200 lashes. The next morning, the executioner came, stripped Martin to the waist, tied his hands together, and led him out of prison. He was put on an ass and received his 200 lashes. After 2 more weeks in jail, he was sent to Malaga until an English ship arrived to carry him home. The Inquisition continued until the invasion of Spain by Napoleon Bonaparte in 1808. After the abdication of the throne by Charles IV in favor of his son Ferdinand VII on February 22, 1813, the Cortes General of the Kingdom assembled in Madrid and decreed that the existence of the Inquisition was no longer in accord with the political constitution that had been adopted by the nation. The bishops and civil courts were returned to their ancient powers, and the oppression of the people of Spain finally ended. Chapter 3. John Wycliffe. John Wycliffe, who lived during the reign of Edward III in 1371, was a public reader of divinity at the University of Oxford. In a time when few people were educated, he was well known for his scholarship in the fields of philosophy and religion. At this time, Christianity was in a sad state. Although everyone knew the name of Christ, few, if any, understood his doctrine. Faith, consolation, the use of the law, the works of Christ, our human weakness, the Holy Ghost, the strength of sin, the works of grace, justification by faith, and Christian liberty were never mentioned in the church. Instead, the church was solely concerned with outward ceremony and human traditions. People spent their entire lives heaping up one ceremony after another in hopes of salvation, not knowing it was theirs for the asking. Simple, uneducated people who had no knowledge of Scripture were content to know only what their pastors told them, and these pastors took care to only teach what came from Rome, most of which was for the profit of their orders, not for the glory of Christ. Wycliffe, seeing Christ's gospel defiled by the errors and invention of these bishops and monks, decided to do whatever he could to remedy the situation and teach people the truth. He took great pains to publicly declare that his only intention was to relieve the church of his idolatry, especially that concerning the sacrament of communion. This, of course, aroused the anger of the country's monks and friars, whose orders had grown wealthy through the sale of their ceremonies and from being paid for doing their duties. Soon, their priests and bishops took up the outcry, followed by the archbishops, Simon Sudbury, who took away Wycliffe's salary at Oxford and ordered him to stop preaching against the church. When even that failed, he appealed to the Pope. Nevertheless, Wycliffe continued speaking his mind to the people in his sermons. King Edward was sympathetic to the preaching, and he also had heard the support of others at high rank, including John of Gaunt and Duke of Lancaster, the king's son, and Lord Henry Percy. The following points taken from Wycliffe's sermons summarize his teachings. The Holy Eucharist, after consecration, is not the actual body of Christ. The Church of Rome is no more important than any other church, and Peter had no more power given to him by Christ than any other apostle. The Pope has no more power than any other priest. The gospel is enough for any man without the rules of men, which add nothing to the gospel. Neither the Pope nor any other church official has the power or right to punish transgressors. In 1377, Wycliffe was ordered to appear before his bishops and answer to their charges, since he had continued to preach on these matters after having been told to stop. He appeared before them on Thursday, February 19, 1377, accompanied by four learned friars, the Duke of Lancaster, and Lord Henry Percy, the Lord Marshal of England. A great crowd of people had gathered around St. Paul's to see and hear the proceedings, and it took Wycliffe's party a long time to make its way through all of them to Our Lady's Chapel, where the church authorities were waiting. In minutes, the Duke of Lancaster and Lord Percy became involved in a heated argument with the bishop over whether Wycliffe should be allowed to sit or must remain standing. Soon, arguments gave way to threats, and the whole assembly joined in taking sides, and the council had to be dissolved before it was even 9 a.m. Wycliffe had escaped punishment for his beliefs. Soon, King Edward III died, and his grandson, Richard II, took the throne. The Duke of Lancaster and Lord Percy gave up their government positions and retired to private life, but Wycliffe still enjoyed the support of many noblemen. In 1377, Pope Gregory sent a message to the University of Oxford, rebuking it for allowing Wycliffe's doctrine to take root and demanding he be silenced. This encouraged the Archbishop of Canterbury and other bishops, who decided to meet and agree on what should be done to punish Wycliffe. On the day Wycliffe was to be examined, a man named Lewis Clifford, who was a member of the prince's court, but not a particularly powerful man, strode up to the bishops and sternly warned them not to pass any sentence on Wycliffe. The bishops were so taken back by his demand that they took no action on Wycliffe that day. Wycliffe's sect continued to grow, despite church opposition. Some authorities at Oxford attempted to silence him. Others gave him whatever support they could. The church considered him a heretic and threatened his followers with excommunication. For some time, Wycliffe was either banished or in hiding, but he returned to his parish of Lutterworth to die in 1384. In 1450, the Synod of Constance declared John Wycliffe a notorious heretic who died in his heresy and ordered his bones removed from consecrated ground. In 1425, Wycliffe was disinterred, his bones burned, and thrown into a river. But there is no denying truth, which will even spring up from the dust and ashes. Although they burned his bones and drowned his ashes, the word of God and the truth of John Wycliffe's doctrine would never be destroyed. Although King Richard allowed himself to be influenced by Popes Urban and Boniface IV and published several decrees against the new Protestant doctrines, there is no record of anyone being put to death for holding them during his reign.
Sir William Sauder. Richard II was deposed in 1399 and succeeded by Henry IV. In 1400, during a meeting of Parliament at Westminster, Sir William Sauder, a good man and a faithful priest, asked permission to speak for the good of the kingdom. The bishops present, suspecting that he wanted to address the subject of religion, convinced Parliament that the matter should be referred to the church convocation. So on February 12, 1400, Thomas Arundel, Archbishop of Canterbury, and his provincial council held a hearing with Sauder. They charged that he had previously renounced several heretical opinions, but continued to teach and preach them. The charges against Sauder, the parish priest of St. Skith, the Virgin in London, were as follows. He would not worship the cross on which Christ suffered. He would rather worship a temporal king, the bodies of saints, or a contrite man than the cross. He thought it was more important for a priest to teach the word of God than to say the canonical hours. He believed that the consecrated bread of communion remains bread, and it is not physically the body of Christ. Sauder was given time to prepare an answer to these charges. Reappearing before the convocation the following Friday, February 18th, he refused to abandon his beliefs, and was given one more day to consider his position. Still adamant, on the 19th, Sauder was ordered stripped of all his church offices, priest, deacon, subdeacon, acolyte, exorcist, reader, sexton, and even doorkeeper. Reduced to the state of layman, Sauder was then handed over to the secular legal authorities, and the church petitioned the king to execute him, something it could not do itself. King Henry readily agreed, becoming the first English king to ever put a heretic to death. Sir William Sauder became the first Englishman to suffer martyrdom in Henry's reign. After Sauder's death, others who believed as he did took pains to conceal themselves while the unpopular king gathered what support he could, doing the will of the church, legally condemning the books of Protestantism and making burning of anyone convicted of heresy legal in England. John Badby. On March 1, 1409, John Badby, a layman, was examined before Thomas Arundel, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and a number of other lords. The principal charge against him was that he believed that bread was not turned into the actual physical body of Christ upon consecration. When the examination was finished, and all the conclusions were read in English, the Archbishop asked Badby if he would renounce his beliefs and adhere to the doctrine of the Catholic faith. He answered that he would stay with his own beliefs. Badby was locked in the friar's mansion, with the archbishop holding the key, until he appeared again on March 15th, was declared a heretic, and turned over to the secular authorities for punishment. That afternoon, John Badby was brought before Smithfield, put in an empty barrel, bound with chains to a stake, and surrounded by dry wood. As he stood there, the king's eldest son happened by, and encouraged Badby to save his life while there was still time, but Badby refused to change his opinions. The barrel was put over him, and the fire lit. When Badby felt the fire, he cried, "Mercy, Lord!" And the prince immediately ordered the fire extinguished. Then he promised Badby a year's stipend from the king if he would return to the faith of the church. Even then, Badby held his ground to the death. After Badby's death, the bishops seeking to suppress this doctrine forever, and knowing that they had a king willing to act on their wishes, drafted a law that condemned the books of heretics and ordered all dioceses to proceed against heretics with zeal. Death by fire was declared the fate of any heretic who would not recant. After this, the Archbishop of Canterbury issued similarly harsh laws against Protestants. With all these laws against them, you would think the Protestants would have been utterly destroyed, and yet such are the works of the Lord that these men multiplied daily instead of being defeated. Their numbers especially increased in London, Lincolnshire, Norfolk, Herefordshire, Shrewsbury, Calais. Some, however, did recant. Among those were John Purvey, who recanted at Paul's Cross, John Edward, priest of the Diocese of Lincoln, Richard Herbert, and Emmett Willie of London, John Becket of London, John Senyans of Lincolnshire. William Thorpe. William Thorpe was a valiant warrior under the banner of Christ. He was examined before the Archbishop of Canterbury in 1407, accused of traveling through England for over 20 years, preaching his reformed beliefs to the people. The Archbishop not only demanded that Thorpe deny his beliefs and return to the Catholic Church, but that he turn in anyone he found holding similar beliefs in the future. He was also forbidden to preach until the Archbishop was sure he was truly converted.
Sir, Thorpe replied, if I agreed to this, I would have to be a spy for every bishop in England. Thorpe refused to pledge unconditional submission to the church. I will willingly obey God and his law, he said, and every member of the Holy Church that agrees with Christ. What happened to Thorpe after he was committed to prison isn't known. There is no record of his being burned, so he may have died in prison or secretly escaped. Poor Christians were being oppressed everywhere, but especially in England at this time, where the king supported the Catholic Church. The church was so strong there that no one could stand against it. Whatever it decreed was obeyed by all men. John Huss. Richard II married a wife native of Bohemia, and through her servants the works of Wycliffe were carried to that country, where they were effectively preached to the people by John Huss of Prague. Pope John XXIII, seeking to suppress the Bohemians, appointed Cardinal de Colomna to look into Huss's preaching and deal with any heresy he might find. So Colomna set a date for Huss to appear before him in Rome. Huss never appeared on the designated date, but King Wenceslas of Bohemia sent ambassadors to assure Colomna that any false doctrine being preached in his country would be taken care of by him at his expense. At the same time, Huss sent his own ambassadors to assure the cardinal he was innocent of heresy. Colomna refused all their pleas and excommunicated Huss for failing to appear in person. The Bohemians couldn't have cared less about the proclamation of excommunication. The more they grew in the knowledge of the Lord through Huss, the less they cared for the Pope and his rules, especially since the church was divided at that time, with three men arguing over the office of Pope. Although the Bohemian church officials succeeded in having Huss banned from Prague, he carried on his work, spreading Wycliffe's message among the people and causing a great uproar over the church's riches and abuses. Wenceslas took advantage of his subject's state of mind to levy heavy taxes on the clergy, silencing them in Bohemia and filling his treasury at the same time. In 1414, a general church conference was held in Constance to resolve the problem of the three popes and also to deal with the Bohemians. Assured of safe conduct by both Emperor Sigismund and one of the popes, Huss traveled to the conference, arriving in Constance on November 3rd. 26 days later, he appeared before the bishops to defend himself, but was not allowed to speak, in violation of the promises made to him. He was imprisoned for, quote, safekeeping, and charged with 8 articles of heresy. On June 7th, 1415, Huss was brought before a council and condemned as a heretic when he refused to recant his support of Wycliffe's theology. He was stripped of all his church offices, made to wear a paper hat with the words arch-heretic, and led past a fire consuming his books. On July 6th, 1415, the hangman stripped Huss of his clothes, tied his hands behind him, and chained his neck to the stake. At that point, Huss told the hangman that he was glad to accept the chains for the Lord's sake. Straw and wood were piled around him to his chin, and the fire was lit. As the flames rose around him, Huss was heard to say over and over, Jesus Christ, the Son of the living God, have mercy on me, until the flames choked him. When all the wood was burned, the upper part of his body was still hanging in the chain, so they threw it down, made a new fire, and burned it after cutting his head into small pieces. When he was totally burned, Huss's ashes were carefully collected and thrown into the Rhone River.